Welcome to Columbus Perspective, a weekly public affairs presentation of The Fan. I'm Kate Burdett. Coming up, Goodwill Columbus is about to open a new location that supports four of the organization's service areas under one roof. Their CEO will tell us more about that. And Jay Fox will talk to an expert about how the new Pregnant Workers Fairness Act impacts workers in Central Ohio. Plus, Doug Petcash of Face the State will have a look at state politics. First up on Columbus Perspective, Goodwill Columbus, now in its 85th year of serving the community, is getting ready to open a brand new facility supporting four of the nonprofit's service areas: retail, donation, free job training, and adult day services. This will be the only Goodwill Columbus location with all four of those services under one roof. And that's why their CEO, Ryan Burgess, is joining us today on Columbus Perspective. Ryan, thanks so much for being here.
Hi, Kate. Thanks for having me.
Well, first off, tell me about this new location. Where is it and when will it open?
Yeah, well, so we'll be opening Thursday, July 18th, with a grand opening. And it's located right off of Stringtown Road at 4178 Buckeye Parkway. But I think most folks probably know where the Target is off of Stringtown Road. So we're in between the Target and the Hobby Lobby, right off Stringtown Road in Grove City.
Well, that makes it really easy to find. Great location.
Yeah.
And I've kind of touched on it, the uniqueness of four different services being under one roof. But can you tell me more about what makes this location really special?
Yeah. So maybe I'll just take a quick step back and just give a quick history lesson on Goodwill, which will help me kind of explain why this is a unique location. So, yes, you're correct. Goodwill has been in Columbus for 85 years, but Goodwill was actually founded in 1902 in Boston by a Methodist minister, Reverend Edgar Helms. And what's neat about our business model is even today, it's very similar to the way Reverend Helms created it in 1902. And what he did is he recognized the need to provide kind of job training skills to individuals coming into Boston. And when you think about 1900 in Boston, it's when many of the European immigrants were coming to our country. So what he did is he took burlap sacks to the Beacon Hill neighborhood, a wealthy neighborhood in, just outside of Boston. And he dropped the burlap sacks off at the residences and said to those folks, hey, whatever you don't need anymore, please put in this burlap sack and I'll come back and get it, which he would do. And then the items he collected, he would sell them. And then the revenue that he generated, he used to operate the job training programs for all the immigrants coming into Boston. So what's neat is our business model is very, very similar to that to today. So at our Grove City location, this will really illustrate the unique enterprise that Goodwill has, where most folks know our brand because of our retail operation, but most folks aren't as aware of all the programs and services that we provide in our communities. So at our Grove City location, we will have a store, we will have a donation center, a drive-through in the back. And then we're also what we call our people services, two components of that. We're going to have a job training center as well as an adult day services hub. One of our legacies here in Columbus over the last 85 years is serving individuals with disabilities. So we're excited to have a presence in Southwest Franklin County to serve those individuals, as well as the need. Central Ohio is growing rapidly. Businesses are looking for people to take all the open positions that they have. So by having a job training center there as well, we feel like we can help address that need for many of the businesses that are located in that part of town. So that's what makes this location unique, is where we have both a retail operation as well as a couple of our people services.
And speaking of the job training services, what are the resources that are available through those job training centers, and who is eligible to use those services?
Yeah. Well, first and foremost, all of our job training programs are free to the individuals who enroll in them. And we are involved in an array of job training programs. We offer basic digital skills training. We offer some basic IT certification programs. We offer the State Tested Nursing Assistant Program, the STNA. It's an entry-level healthcare certification. Just the last couple years, we partnered with a firm to offer the CDL, the commercial driver's license, the truck driving license. And then we're just about to launch a broadband technician training program. And so everybody needs Wi-Fi today. Everybody needs a way to connect their devices. We just need more folks who can actually install the wires to make Wi-Fi work. So we're going to be offering a broadband technician training program. So we are involved in workforce development efforts in a lot of different ways. We are focused on serving individuals 18 years of age and older. So we are focused on adults. However, anyone and everyone that's looking to maybe move to their next best opportunity or who may have to pivot from one career path to another, we are here to serve them.
Wow, that is quite a bit. Ryan Burgess is the CEO of Goodwill Columbus. This Thursday, they are opening a brand new facility in Grove City on the south side that's going to have four different programs under one roof: retail, donation, free job training, which we just learned a lot more about, and adult day services. Ryan, I wanted to ask a little more about the adult day services. What do those involve?
Yeah, so as I mentioned earlier, we have been committed to serving individuals with disabilities for 85 years in Columbus. And what that means is we're helping individuals acquire life and job skills to help them become the best of who they are. We offer community-based services, I guess, compared to facility-based services. So every day we have teams of individuals. Our direct service professionals are responsible for teams of four or five individuals, typically, and they have them out in the community exploring employment opportunities, developing life skills by visiting cultural attractions throughout Columbus. Again, just helping individuals get to their next best opportunity. And it's kind of a part of our DNA here at Goodwill Columbus, and we are proud to offer those services.
Now, the Stringtown Road Grove City location is the third Goodwill store opening within a 12-month span. Ryan, if you would, tell us a little more about the growth you're experiencing in terms of meeting the community where people are.
Yeah. So we're trying to keep up with the growth of Central Ohio. It's just an exciting time to be in Columbus with all the growth and prosperity that we're experiencing. So over the last couple of years, we've been spreading our programs and services out into the neighborhoods, out into the community to make them more accessible. A year ago, we left our Edge Hill campus, our main campus that was kind of near Grandview. And so for many, many years, most of our programs and services were held there. So everybody had to come to our campus. So part of our strategy to make our programs more accessible is we sold that property, frankly, a year ago. And with that, we took those proceeds to invest in infrastructure across our footprint to make it easier for people to get to us. So on the east side, off of Bryce Road, we have a store there along with a job training center. In Clintonville, just a year ago, we opened a store with a job training center connected there. And then right downtown here, where our administrative offices are located, in the Brewery District, we have a job training center there as well. And so, again, it's really the point of that is to make ourselves more accessible to individuals across the community. And then finally, last year as well, we moved our art studio. We have a program for individuals with disabilities where we have art programming available to them, and we positioned that right next to our Whitehall store. And this is all intentional because, as I mentioned earlier in our conversation, most folks just think we're a retail operator. So now, by having one of our people services right next door to one of our stores, our shoppers and our donors can see the individuals who benefit from their patronage when they come into our stores or when they donate to us. So, we are spreading our footprint out across Franklin County, just making ourselves more accessible.
That footprint continues to grow and all good things coming from it. I would imagine, too, in your retail locations, you might be noticing the trend that we're starting to hear about and see on social media where people are saying, stop making new clothes, stop buying new clothes. There's plenty that already exist. Go thrifting. I bet that's pretty good for business, too.
Yes. No, it's very exciting. I mean, thrifting right now is very, very popular with young people because of their commitment to sustainability and reuse. And Goodwill has been at the forefront of reuse since 1902. So while it's recently become trendy, Goodwill has been doing this for a long, long time. And we're looking for solutions. We recognize that we have more work to do. There's just a lot of excess goods that we receive. So we do everything in our power to find donated goods a new home, to provide ways where all these materials that we get can be reused in some fashion. So we are strongly committed to reuse and finding ways to recirculate all the donated items that we receive.
On Thursday, the grand opening of the new Goodwill location in Grove City is happening, and there's a lot of other things happening, too, as you've heard CEO Ryan Burgess tell us here for the last few minutes. Ryan, where can we go online to learn more about Goodwill Columbus?
Yeah, our website, goodwillcolumbus.org, goodwillcolumbus.org. If you go there, you can find easy-to-read information about all the programs and services that we provide, as well as if you're looking to donate or shop in one of our locations, in a map there that can help get you to the right place.
Excellent. Ryan Burgess, CEO of Goodwill Columbus, keep up the great work, and thank you so much for joining us today on Columbus Perspective.
Thank you, Kate. The Fan.
This is Columbus Perspective on The Fan. Here's Jay Fox.
We're talking today with Charlotte Burrows, who is the chair of the U.S. Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, about legislation that impacts more than 5,000 workers here in Columbus alone. The piece of legislation is called the Pregnant Workers Fairness Act. It went into effect June 27th of 2023, and new regulations went into effect June 18th of this year. The first question I have for you, Charlotte, is why was this legislation necessary in the first place?
Well, hello. And it was unfortunately necessary because there were many employers who were not providing basic accommodations to pregnant workers. The Pregnant Workers Fairness Act provides employees and job applicants who are pregnant or have recently given birth with access to changes on the job so they can work safely, which we call reasonable accommodations. And to be really specific, these are things like taking time off for medical attention in order to avoid problems during the pregnancy, being able to drink water, or lifting lighter loads on the job. So this is an important issue. Lots of people get pregnant. It's a normal part of life and work. And really, Congress was looking at the fact that it had not been treated as such. And it was necessary to have a law to make sure that it would be.
So we know that for healthcare providers who are dealing with the OBGYN process, 56% of pregnant women work full-time during pregnancy, 73% return to work within 6 months after giving birth. So are these accommodations both prenatal and postpartum?
That's correct. It covers pregnancy, childbirth, and related medical conditions. So that can happen during the pregnancy, and it can happen afterwards as well. And it's important to know that workers can really just make a really simple request and for those accommodations at any point if they are related to pregnancy, childbirth, or related medical conditions.
Now, women who work in the workforce really transcend every type of employment that is available today. So one would think that accommodations that would need to be made for someone who, say, for example, works in an office might be different for some that works in an industrial job or perhaps as a bus driver or something like that. How detailed does this act get into the minutiae of individual jobs?
The statute does not get into the minutiae of individual jobs very far for exactly that reason. It would be absolutely impossible to list off every potential issue. But it did talk about, in the legislative history, when Congress was looking at this, some very specific things that unfortunately come up a lot and transcend different employment situations. Things like being able to take a break to drink water or being able to sit down or stand up when you need to, or to eat at regular times. The other thing that comes up a lot, and that is discussed in the EEOC's new regulation, which Congress instructed us to issue, is that people sometimes need time off for, you know, just going to the doctor in order to have a healthy pregnancy. So those are the kinds of things that when Congress said we should provide some examples, we address in the new rule.
Did any of the traditional disability legislation come into play? For example, workplaces that have excessive stairs but require elevators, ramps, things of that nature. Does any of that play into this at all?
So there's not a requirement that employers change things like adding ramps or stairs, but the provisions of the Americans with Disabilities Act that have to do with other kinds of accommodations for individual workers are very much part of the what Congress had in mind when it wrote this statute and really looked to those kinds of accommodations. So both the idea of accommodating the worker and the fact that an employer won't have to do it if it's really going to cause them significant difficulty or expense, those really are borrowed from the Americans with Disabilities Act in this instance.
So if I am one of these workers, what is the process that I have to go through? Do I have to go to my human resource director or my direct supervisor? You know, how do I receive these accommodations?
That is such an excellent question. There's no special words that have to be used. The employer should tell them, the worker should go to human resources, or they can go to their supervisor or someone else who's been designated by the employer and just articulate, just say, frankly, that they have a limitation and they need an adjustment or change in their working conditions due to that limitation, which is related to pregnancy, childbirth, or related medical conditions. So, for instance, a worker can say, I'm having trouble getting to work at my scheduled starting time because of morning sickness, or I need more bathroom breaks because of my pregnancy, or I need time off to go to a medical appointment because of my pregnancy. And that request, again, can be made to a supervisor or person who regularly assigns tasks or other officials at the employer. And then it's just a matter of the employer and the employee communicating, whether by talking, emails, or however they choose to do it, about the limitation and the adjustment that's needed for work. And we think that most of those requests really can be granted quickly through this type of conversation. And Congress really put that right into the statute that there should be an interactive process between the employer and the employee. And so hopefully that can resolve most of these things fairly quickly.
Now, 100 years ago, when my wife gave birth to our first child, she was asked by her employer to take leave. She wanted to keep working. Now, obviously, these weren't in place 20, 30 years ago. What is the situation now if an employer says, you know what, I think you need to take leave, but yet the employee wants to keep working?
That is so vital for people to understand. Employees should not be required to accept an accommodation that hasn't been discussed with or they haven't agreed to unless it's there's not some other reasonable accommodation that could be given instead. So leave is often unpaid, so it really matters and whether or not something else can be offered instead. So it shouldn't be used as a reasonable accommodation unless it's the accommodation that the employee actually requested, or there's no other reasonable accommodation that does not create an undue hardship for the employer. And again, undue hardship in this context means significant difficulty or expense, and that's measured in relation to the size and the resources that that particular employer has. So we really encourage employers and employees to communicate early and often to understand the limitation the employees need and to make sure that they explore potential accommodations. And again, that interactive process is required under the law. There are some suggestions that if they can't figure it out themselves, the U.S. Department of Labor has a Job Accommodation Network, or JAN, that can help, and it gives free confidential accommodation assistance.
So last question for you today, Charlotte. Let's say that the employer does not want to comply. I'm the worker. What do I do?
Well, obviously, if the worker has sort of exhausted its ability to have to persuade, we at the EEOC also have under the statute both the responsibility and the tools to take action on the employee's behalf. That employee can bring what's called a charge of discrimination to the EEOC. We act as a neutral, investigate it, and first we try to bring some sort of settlement. If we can't, we have the ability to bring that charge forward to court, and we do that regularly under all the statutes that we enforce. So that is an option. The employee also can file their own suit in addition to ours or instead of ours if that's what they choose to do.
So if you are in the WBNS listening area and you want to learn more about this, you can call the EEOC at 1-800-669-4000. You can also visit them online at eeoc.gov. And note that support is provided in English and also in 200 other languages. So we want to thank Charlotte Burroughs, Chair of the U.S. Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, for joining us today. And for Columbus Perspective, I'm Jay Fox.
The Fan.
This is Columbus Perspective on The Fan. Now, courtesy of our sister station, WBNS 10 TV, here's Doug Petcash from the Sunday morning public affairs program Face the State. A new edition can be seen this morning at 11:30 on 10TV.
We start today with the group pushing to reform Ohio's legislative map drawing system. They took a major step toward putting the issue on the November ballot for you, the voters, to decide. Citizens Not Politicians delivered hundreds of thousands of petition signatures to the Secretary of State's office 2 days before the deadline. They say their proposed constitutional amendment will end political gerrymandering in Ohio.
Citizens Not Politicians opened the door to possible changes in how Ohio's political boundaries are drawn. Supporters of the effort to give citizens the power to draw legislative and congressional district maps unloaded boxes from two moving trucks at Secretary of State Frank LaRose's office. They say the boxes contained petitions with more than 730,000 voter signatures. To get the proposed constitutional amendment on the November 5th ballot, they need 413,000 of them to be valid. Volunteer Abby Buckerfield helped gather the signatures.
Putting the maps in the hands of our citizens, not the politicians, to end gerrymandering in the state of Ohio.
Let me ask you something. Whose house?
A short time later, a much larger crowd rallied in favor of the ballot initiative at the State House.
Because I do believe that gerrymandering is wrong, no matter which political side does it.
I want a future for my children where every vote counts and every voice is heard.
Retired Ohio Supreme Court Chief Justice Maureen O'Connor, a Republican, has pushed for the effort.
This constitutional amendment will restore power to Ohio citizens and take away from the self-serving politicians and their lobbyist friends and big money donors.
The current Ohio Redistricting Commission is made up of four state lawmakers and three statewide office holders. The commission draws new maps after every U.S. census. Since the 2020 census, the Ohio Supreme Court rejected five state legislative maps and two congressional maps as unconstitutionally gerrymandered to favor Republicans. If voters approve the amendment, the new commission would have five Republican, five Democrat, and five independent citizen members from across the state. Republican Senate President Matt Huffman opposes the ballot initiative.
I think that the people who are making an important decision like this ought to be elected officials who are accountable to the public, not unknown bureaucrats somewhere, someplace.
Supporters believe the amendment will pass.
The amendment is written in a way to end gerrymandering as quickly as possible.
Now, you heard Senate President Republican Matt Huffman say he thinks the commission should be made up of elected officials who are accountable to the public, not unknown bureaucrats. He laid out two other concerns with the proposed constitutional amendment.
The second thing is they've removed all of the controls or restrictions on how you can draw districts. So we negotiated with the Democrats and Republicans and all these good government groups over really a few years, but it removes the restrictions on dividing local communities, communities of interest, cities, counties, townships, making sure there are compact districts. They could easily draw an elongated district, which goes from Cincinnati all the way up to Hardin County. Why would I say that? Because that was one of the maps that was submitted by folks on this. So those two are big problems. Thirdly, this commission will be able to request or demand whatever money they want from the state of Ohio. The Constitution says we have to pay them. That's a real problem. What if they decide, well, you know, we want to hire these folks and we're going to pay them $500,000 apiece and we're going to need a staff of 10 people. We have to pay them. That's what the Constitution of the state of Ohio will say that. So there's a lot of more detail, but basically what I would say is no accountability, no restrictions on how you can draw districts, and no financial accountability. Those are three big problems.
And earlier this week, League of Women Voters of Ohio Executive Director Jen Miller came to the 10 TV studio. I asked her more about the Citizens Not Politicians movement, what prompted them to push for a constitutional amendment to change the Ohio Redistricting Commission, and what her response is to Senate President Huffman's concerns. Jen, first of all, how big of a step in the process was dropping off the 713,000 signatures?
It was a momentous step. We had thousands of volunteers in every county of the state collecting signatures, talking to their neighbors about why we need to end gerrymandering by banning politicians from drawing maps that favor them.
Are you confident that 413,000 of them will be validated in order that voters will be able to have a say on this on November 5th?
Yeah, we've been checking the quality all through, and so we are confident that we will make the ballot, and we're very excited about it.
How were all of these signatures collected? You know, how long did it take? What's the process to make sure that they are, you know, make sure they're valid?
Right. So we first had to go through steps with the Secretary of State and then the AG, and then we were collecting signatures for several months, you know, through the fall, around Thanksgiving, through the holidays. We had volunteers in the cold and the rain and now in the heat to make sure that we got enough signatures.
And what would this constitutional amendment actually do in practicality?
So it's actually quite simple, and I think most Ohioans will understand this, that politicians at the end of the day are most interested in their next reelection, right? And so when they are in charge of making the maps, they can rig them so that they will win over and over again. This ends gerrymandering and the undue, unfair influence that politicians have in creating their own districts by banning politicians and lobbyists from doing the drawing.
Currently, the Redistricting Commission is made up of seven members. It's four state representatives or senators and also three statewide office holders. What would the new commission, if approved by voters, be comprised of?
So there would be no politicians, no lobbyists, but there'd be five Republicans, five Democrats, five independents. That would be everyday Ohioans from across the state, many different demographics, to draw these maps. And it would be done through a truly impartial, fair, and transparent process.
And who can be on the board then?
Yep.
Anyone?
You know, yeah, there will be a call for applications, and it can be teachers and nurses, firefighters, maybe stay-at-home parents. Mm-hmm. Wide range of individuals can apply, and they will be selected to be on this panel.
And is that worked out yet, how they'll be selected?
Yeah. It's very well thought out. There will be retired judges who really help narrow the pool down, make sure that the individuals that have applied are qualified, that they do qualify. And then they will draw six randomly. So two Republicans, two Democrats, two independents. That six will work together to fill out the rest of the commission.
Okay. So why is this necessary, this whole thing, to put the amendment through? Why do you feel like it's needed?
Right. So Ohio has some of the worst gerrymandering in the country. And we know that when politicians can draw maps to favor themselves and their friends. They don't listen to us. They don't actually have to compete for votes. They're mathematically proven that they're going to win this election over and over again. That's bad for every Ohio voter. And so we need to end gerrymandering so that we can have a responsive government. Keep in mind that the commission has drawn maps that have been struck down by the Ohio Supreme Court 7 times. There's no accountability in our current system. Lawmakers are making the maps that they want to make and then choosing to ignore the Ohio Constitution and the Ohio Supreme Court.
Now, on the other side of that, mentioning that, Senate President Matt Huffman, who can select a representative to be on the current commission, he has concerns about the ballot initiative. He believes elected officials should be on it because they are accountable to the voters and could be voted out of office if that were to be the case. He also believes the amendment removes all the controls or restrictions on dividing local communities. And he says the new commission could request all the money that it wants from the state to pay for staffing and other costs of operation, and the state would have to give it based on the Constitution. How do you respond to those concerns?
So there's a lot of concerns being thrown out there, but let's start with what will happen with communities. So first and foremost, this commission has to listen to Ohio voters on how they want their lines drawn. We instead had 2 years of mapping where Ohio voters were showing up, talking to this commission about what they wanted out of their maps and being ignored, and then having those same maps be struck down in the Ohio Supreme Court and have the Ohio Supreme Court be ignored. There are rules about keeping communities together, school districts, communities. We have across the state places like Ganaden-Hutton and District 6. That's 1,200 people. And it is split into 2 congressional districts. Our current system is not keeping communities together at all. And it's not fair.
What about the funding aspect of it? Was the formula that the amendment writers came up with kind of based off of how much the current commission spent to make this all work? Or, you know, how is the funding going to work out?
Well, the funding is based on how other similar commissions in the state operate. So this will not be a runaway spending. If we want to talk about runaway spending, we should talk about how much money the state spent on all of these lawsuits where our maps were struck down 7 times by the Ohio Supreme Court. That was really hard on taxpayers. This commission will be funded similar to other commissions.
All right, so what is next now? The signatures have been handed in. They're at the Secretary of State's office. What is next for Citizens Not Politicians as this plays out?
Right. So right now, our hardworking elections officials in all the counties will be verifying the signatures. And I know we're going to make the ballot. And then we're going to have our neighbor-to-neighbor campaign where everyday Ohioans talk to other voters about why they should support Citizens Not Politicians in the ballot box this fall.
I've heard a lot of people who are part of this effort be very confident about this passing in November. Why are you confident that this will get through?
So we had thousands of volunteers assisting us in collecting these signatures. And I can tell you that every day we were hearing from people of Ohio wanting to sign, wanting to volunteer from all stripes, all ages, all political affiliations, all geographic locations in Ohio. People are excited. They know that gerrymandering is harming our democracy. It is harming our representation. It's polluting our politics in a way that lawmakers are not responsive to the people of Ohio.
Jen, thank you so much for your time today. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
So here's what's next. The Secretary of State's office will now work with county boards of elections to determine if there are enough valid signatures to put the measure on the November ballot. That work is expected to take a few weeks. There are a couple bills in the Ohio House regarding voting laws. One is House Bill 546. It would require the state's election ballots to have an identifying watermark. The other is House Bill 552, or the Voter Verification Act. It would require election officials to verify certain information in voter registration records. Both bills are currently in House committee.
Columbus Perspective is a public affairs presentation of WBNS Radio. The opinions expressed on this program are those of its guests and do not necessarily reflect those of WBNS Radio, its staff, management, or sponsors.
The Fan.
This is Columbus Perspective on The Fan. Here's more from Face the State, courtesy of 10TV.
A petition looking to increase the minimum wage here in Ohio hit a roadblock. Raise the Wage Ohio did not submit signatures for the initiative by the deadline. That means a $15 minimum wage will not be on the ballot this November. 10TV's Tara Jabor talked to people on both sides of the issue.
Voters won't see a $15 minimum wage initiative on the ballot in November.
I'm a little bit jaded to not see it on the ballot. Honestly, I was hoping to vote for it.
We spoke to people in the Short North about what they think about the possibility of a $15 minimum wage. Anna Evans says she signed the initiative and supports it.
Inflation is kind of bonkers these days, and so you got to be able to pay for groceries and you got to be able to pay for rent. So, absolutely.
For some, it's personal.
I know firsthand that's just not enough money to support oneself living here in Columbus. It's just not feasible. It doesn't make it enough for food, rent, living expenses.
But other people told us they worry about the side effects of having a $15 minimum wage. Jonathan Kuiper, a server in the Short North, says he wishes he could support it, but is too worried about the prices of other things also going up.
I feel as if increasing the minimum wage isn't going to solve the problem that we have with having to pay more for certain things, such as the increase for food, gas prices, really just about anything. As much as I want to get paid more, I just don't want to pay more for the current things that already cost exorbitant amounts of money.
One man told us he thinks a higher minimum wage would take away the opportunity for some people to work.
Minimum wage is not intended to be, you know, a living wage where you could support a family on, right? Those are typically meant for, you know, entry-level jobs. You know, it's a complete, you know, gutting of companies.
But he feels the people of Ohio should get to decide what the minimum wage is.
Yes, I believe that it should be able to be something that could be voted on, even though I don't agree with a high mandate on a minimum wage, but I absolutely believe that people should have their voice, you know, to be able to vote for that.
We spoke to Raise the Wage Ohio to see what's next. A spokesperson tells us they'll submit their signatures by the end of the summer and hope to be on the ballot in 2025. The Ohio Restaurant and Hospitality Alliance was strongly against this initiative, saying it thinks the higher minimum wage would hurt tipped workers such as servers and bartenders.
When it comes to a gun suicide attempt, all it takes is a moment.
Heather and I had an argument just like any other couple. I was lost. I had snapped. I had a gun, and I was going to take my own life. Heather helped me realize that there was still a life to live for the better of myself, my family. My weapon is now safely put away.
A moment of crisis can happen to anyone. Store your guns, locked, unloaded, and away from ammo. Hear more safe stories at endfamilyfire.org. Brought to you by Brady and the Ad Council.
Since the first presidential debate, much of the focus is on President Biden's poor performance, in which he lost his train of thought and said some things that didn't make sense. A question some have been asking is whether he should bow out of the race and let someone else run. So far, the president says he's not going anywhere. Another question surrounding the debate was who will be former President Trump's running mate this time around. Ohio Senator J.D. Vance was there at the debate in Atlanta. He is considered a top contender for Trump's vice presidential pick. Trump said his VP pick would most likely be at the debate, but still has yet to announce who his choice is. Here's what Senator Vance had to say that night about the rumors and the possibility.
Have I talked directly with Donald Trump about it? No. I talked to him actually yesterday. We talked about the debate for a while. We talked about some of the things that I thought Joe Biden would say. And we talked just generally about the election, about some Senate races that he has an interest in. Didn't talk about vice president once.
Two other leading candidates for Trump's possible running mate are North Dakota Governor Doug Burgum and Florida Senator Marco Rubio. Both were also at the debate. There is perhaps no greater honor for a parent than to see your child fulfill their dreams by wanting to be just like you. In this case, a sheriff's deputy. It happened in Marion, where the son of a deputy was sworn in to serve and protect. As 10TV reporter Kevin Landers explains, the only person not there to see it was the father he barely knew.
The Winfield name is back on the chest of a Marion County deputy, and no one is more speechless than Landon Winfield's mother, Sarah.
He looks so much like your father right now, spitting image.
Brandy Winfield was shot and killed in the line of duty 20 years ago. He offered to assist a man whose car was broken down. That man later shot Brandy to death in his cruiser. He's serving a 40-year-to-life prison term. Winfield's funeral drew law enforcement from across the state. 3-year-old Landon was there, and ever since, he says, he's dreamed of wearing the uniform his dad wore.
I kind of took as my calling that I want to carry my family's name, which I'm doing right now. And it's like one of the proudest moments of my life. I think he'd be pretty damn proud of me choosing Marion County to start out.
His father's murder left his mom a widow at 27 and having to raise 2 young boys. Sarah says she tried to convince her son to be a firefighter, but that wasn't the Winfield way.
He doesn't want to do anything else, and what do I say to a kid that's his dream?
A dream both wish could be witnessed by Landon's dad, a dad who inspired his son to serve his community and carry on the family name in Marion. Kevin Landers, 10TV News.
Brandy Winfield was 29 years old when he lost his life. In his memory, there is a wing of the Sheriff's Department named after him.
Again, that's Doug Petcash, courtesy of our sister station, WBNS 10TV. From the Sunday morning public affairs program, Face the State. A new edition can be seen this morning at 11:30 on 10TV. This has been Columbus Perspective, a weekly public affairs presentation of The Fan, heard each Sunday morning at 6 on WBNS-FM 97.1 The Fan and on 1460 AM ESPN Columbus.